Welcome to the AI Podcast. I'm Max Mitchell, podcast editor here at Engelsberg Ideas. And today I'm joined by the historian Kathleen Burke. Welcome, Kathleen.
Many thanks.
Kathleen is a Professor Emerita at the University College London, but you're also a much respected wine critic and lover of wine. And you're here to talk about your new book, Wine, A Global History. Wine is not your day job. So tell our listeners how you came to love wine and how it came to be a big part of your life.
Grew up with it, grew up on a grape farm in California and had to go out and pick grapes and tie vines and drive tractor and so forth, family farm. Berkeley had a boyfriend with a 750cc motorcycle, and he drove me around Napa, and he drove and I drank and didn't have the concept of spitting out then. Oxford is where I started really learning about European wines and got my first taste of, I suppose that's what I could say, of tasting properly. And my husband and I drank a lot of wine, different wines, bought a lot of different wines. But by the late 90s, I began to want to appreciate wine. Why was wine good other than just liking it? So I sat the wine trade exams. And after that, people asked me to judge and to write and so forth. And from about 2000, I've been writing reasonably long articles for a particularly good wine periodical called The World of Fine Wine. And I continue to share wine and drink it and talk about it and write about it. And it's taken over my life, but certainly it's different from Anglo-American relations, which is my previous main line of country.
Quite. It's definitely a change of tone from the history of diplomacy and the special relationship. But the book is wonderful, and it is a global journey. It takes us really everywhere through time and space and the history of wine. But what is the earliest evidence we have for a wine drinking culture?
It depends on what you mean by culture, of course. But the earliest we know is about 8,000 BC. And wine wasn't invented, it was discovered, essentially. And we don't know how. We know that probably that was the beginning of its use in religion, because how was it made? It must be gods, all this bubbling stuff and, drinking a lot of it and falling over on the floor and waking up with headaches and nausea. Also, it became very early a medicine wine. But the main thing, of course, until writing is developed, is archaeology. We would not know about wine or a great many other things before the advent of writing if we didn't have archaeology. And so think of all those archaeologists going out and carefully digging and sluicing and putting things together, little bits of amphorae, which wine was made in and stored in and carried in, and with pointed bottoms. And they spent a lot of time putting these bits together. And it was discovered fairly early on that when there were stains in the sides and bottoms of some of these, and testing it, and it came out with tartaric acid. And that became the fingerprint of wine, so that from the earliest they could see how it developed. This came from archaeology. We wouldn't have it otherwise.
And another discovery from archaeology is that the actual wine grape that we have today is quite different from the wine grape before it was domesticated. So you write in the book that the modern vine is hermaphroditic. It doesn't need insects to pollinate it. How did cultures figure out that you needed to do something to this grape to change it in some way?
Well, you're quite right. There tends to be a female grapevine and a male grapevine. And somehow, whether by a man or a woman or bees, when they crossbred, and then you're quite right, the vine became hermaphroditic. And that's because the female vine would produce sort of grape-like things. And so when that happened, that's when you could start getting the grape juice and make wine. So not only archaeology, but bees, I think, nowadays is. But that's how that means domesticating a vine, is bringing the two together somehow. And it's domesticated grapes that produce the grapes that we make wine out of. And we're talking about the Caucasus. Now, we're talking about Georgia, which is probably where the original wine came from. That's, at this point, the earliest archaeological evidence comes from this part of the Caucasus. And people tested it, and they figured out what it was, and I mean, the usual sort of development. But it tastes nice. They found out fairly early that it tastes nice.
And what role did the Canaanites and the Phoenicians play in the spread of wine culture across the Mediterranean?
Yes, the Canaanites are some of my heroes. Land of Canaan, which includes what is now Lebanon and Israel and parts of Syria and so forth, that was essentially the Canaanites that lived on the coast. They all lived on the coast. And right in their area was the Baca Valley in Lebanon, which is one of the great wine-producing areas now. And what they did, what the Egyptian pharaohs liked, for example, was the cedars of Lebanon, which was the great wood to build things with. And so the Canaanites would take their ships full of cedars of Lebanon, but they would take along an amphora or two of wine, and also the goods used to drink it, a cup and a ladle and a strainer and so forth. And they gave these to the kings and the pharaohs. And they decided they wanted to make their own wine. And who did they turn to? The Canaanites. Well, the same thing happened in Crete, Cyprus. And the Canaanites, in due course, were supplanted, one might say, by the Phoenicians in the same area. They essentially grew out of each other. It wasn't an invasion or anything. And they did the same thing, and they moved it down the Mediterranean, all the way, in fact, to Spain. One thing the Phoenicians did was to found Carthage in Tunisia. And Carthage as well, they had hundreds of acres of vines, and they also began to export it where the Etruscans were in Italy, which is now Tuscany, of course. So it was these men who actually were responsible. And then, of course, the Greeks got into the action and tried to shove out the Phoenicians, and then in due course, it was Rome who shut out the Greeks, and on we went.
And so what kind of wine was this that everyone was drinking in the ancient world? What would it taste like, and how was it made? And was it different from the kind of wine that we drink today?
It's not different from sweet wine that we drink today. The point is, in the olden days, including, in fact, practically till the 17th century, wine was all sweet. The Greeks loved sweet wine. Remember, there was very little sugar, just honey. So if you were wealthy enough, you got a lot of your sweetness from sweet wine. And wine that's very sweet also is, the sugar preserves it. So even today, if you buy a sweet wine, say Sauterne or any of the others, it lasts a long time, even when it's open. So that was, sure, was the main attraction. And if you didn't have sugar, of course, because everyone had to make wine, better than water, get calories when you don't have much else to eat. Bread and wine was more than just an invocation. it was a lifeline. That's what you drank. So essentially, wine was everywhere. Everywhere in the European continent. It had its own origins elsewhere, of course.
You spend a chapter on the Greeks and another chapter on the Romans. How did they treat wine differently from one another?
Well, in Greece, it had well, there were three approaches to it. First of all, men met in symposia and drank good wine and talked about philosophy and talked about politics and talked about sex. And that was some of it, as in Plato, gave a rather polished version. The poor drank at taverns, where you'd go and you wouldn't pay that much, but a decent amount for them, and they would buy wine and they could buy food and they could get drunk there, or they could take it home and get drunk. Women weren't allowed to drink wine. It was thought that it would loosen women's libido, because women are naturally lusty, of course. They can hardly keep their hands off men if they had drunk. So men didn't like their wives to drink, because who knows what they get up to. The Romans, one real difference is that women were taken just as natural. They went to dinner parties with men, which you didn't do in Greece. They could drink themselves. Greece, if a husband found his wife drinking and he killed her for it, beat her to death, that was seen as quite all right, because who knew what his wife was going to get up to? And so it was much looser, much more widely spread in Rome. There wasn't that. I mean, obviously, there are also always going to be dinner parties who have different sorts of, but on the whole, it was a general thing. And everyone drank it to keep themselves healthy. If you were poor, gave you calories, could actually seem to cure things. And if you were richer, besides that sort of thing, it was pleasure. And pleasure was celebrated in the Roman Empire.
And remaining in the ancient world, Christopher Nolan's adaptation of The Odyssey is out in cinemas at the moment, and it seems to be all anyone can talk about. And one of the great scenes in The Odyssey is when Odysseus plies the Cyclops with sweet wine before driving a burning stake through his eye. That is described as Maronian wine. What would that have been like? What kind of wine is that?
Well, it was a dark red, very sweet, highly alcoholic wine.
Which most people would drink with water.
Well, yes, both the Greeks and the Romans diluted their wine. In Greece, the usual dilution ratio is 20 waters to one wine. The wine was a bit strong. The Romans diluted it a bit, 3 to 2 or something like that, but not like the Greeks did. The Romans were much more laid back, as it were, about wine and about what it was like and what it might do. But the Maronian wine and other wines like that, some of the great wines came from Lesbos, for example, Celophonia, Crete, and those wines were all sweet. They didn't really like dry wine. That is a later development.
One of the interesting movements in the kind of history of wine was the fall of the Roman Empire. And you write that vines need political stability to grow and for trade routes to be safe enough for wine to be sold. So what happens to wine after the fall of the Roman Empire and during late antiquity?
Well, there wasn't much Mediterranean wine trade because of the pirates. So they had to go by land if they could go. One reason that wine sort of didn't disappear but became much less widely grown was that, of course, they were invaded and conquered by various of the so-called barbarian tribes who preferred beer. So they didn't worry about the vines. Either they ripped them up or they ignored them, whatever. It was after Charlemagne came to power, later the great emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. And he was a very organized man. So he gave rules that were sent around his domain saying, cleanliness, be careful of the fields. I want some of this wine back to me as part of my thing. But the point is also there was a great period largely of peace. And so people started growing vines again, essentially. And Charlemagne, in fact, then, because a lot of what is now Germany was then part of his empire, and he was a great Christian, he then encouraged monasteries to open up all along the Rhine, which later became known as the River of Wine. And the thing about the monasteries, of course, they had to have wine for the liturgy, and also their duty to help travelers who stopped, who, of course, would expect wine. So wine was carried through Germany and from there through into, you know, Poland and so forth. This originated with the rules set out by Charlemagne and his encouragement of this export of wine.
And yes, so you say that pilgrimage had a lot to do with wine growing in the Middle Ages and also the Crusades and the wine needed for soldiers. Could you tell us a bit about how religious orders played into this revival of wine in Europe?
Well, they had already in Europe, you know, all over the place, as it were. I mean, there were 400 Cistercian monasteries within the generation of their foundation, for example. So the place was littered with religious organizations of one sort or another. Now, when it was safer, well, relatively safe, people went on pilgrimages. We all know about Canterbury Tales. That's a pilgrimage to Thomas a Becket's tomb in Canterbury Cathedral. But they especially wanted to go to the Holy Land. And again, what you drank was wine. And so this really encouraged Rome to grow, to produce wine again. These monasteries were already along the area. You stopped there and they had to have wine. The Crusaders also needed wine. And one thing that they did, they encouraged the drinking of wine. They encouraged their men to drink wine because that helped provide courage and strength. And it was obviously one of God's products, and so their people and monasteries, along with them, planted vines all over the holy places and so forth. So the Crusades really encouraged the pilgrimages, and the Crusades really encouraged the development of wine because there were thousands of people who wanted it to drink. So that really made it an incredible trade.
And speaking of the courage that soldiers got from drinking wine, there's a phrase for that, Dutch courage. And the Dutch play a very important part in the history of wine, which I found very interesting. After the Venetians and the Genoans and their kind of city-states controlling it for a while, how do the Dutch, this swampy little country on the North Sea, how did they come to rule the waves and, by proxy, the wine trade?
Well, for one thing, they had the largest merchant marine in the world. And they worked their way out around South Africa to the Dutch East Indies. And there, of course, for the Virgin Islands, the East Indies. The Dutch were the great traders. And they also encouraged the production of wine. That was one of their main trades. But also, one thing they did that was important, they had built all these dikes to provide land for them to build on. Well, they also drained the area of Bordeaux, which is, of course, one of the major top wine producing areas in the world. So they did that. They also needed more white wine for their taverns at home. And so they encouraged, they discovered, they helped produce wines in Sauternes, but also the Loire, the white wines of the Loire. These are the Dutch. They discovered them, they encouraged them, they traded with them then. And indeed, they also helped. When Britain and France were at war, which they were an awful lot, I mean, 49 years in the 18th century, they were at war. And so the Dutch helped smuggle it into to Britain. So in that sense, the Dutch, for three centuries, was the motor of the trade and the motor of developments of wine of different areas, different types.
And during this period, we start to see a slight change in the kinds of wine. It becomes less strong, or at least all the time you start having wines that people call claret because it's quite clear and it's not quite so gloopy like a dessert wine. How does this change come about? Do people's palates quite take to these more acidic, watery wines, as it were?
Well, remember that there was this Hundred Years' War between Britain and France, and England controlled a lot of Aquitaine or Gascony, whatever areas they called, and they produced wine. And the wine that was produced, the grapes that were used and the way it was produced, was light red wine. As you say, it was claret coming from the clarity, the lightness and the clarity of it. So in Britain, they became quite fond of this lighter wine. Also, that was what they could get from their own empire then. So it was drier, it was lighter, and it wasn't, as you put, gloopy and sweet. And the taste developed, that's all, especially amongst the aristocracy in Britain. And that's interesting because not only in France, but elsewhere, but especially in France, the English were considered to have the greatest palates in the world. And even today, this country has the most knowledgeable and adventurous consumer market for wine in the world. And so often, and it's a real center of that, and so often foreign wine producers bring it to London in the hopes that it will take off in London. People come here to taste it, people buy it, and if they can establish a market here, that is a jumping off place for elsewhere. So the English, as wine drinkers and wine appreciators, has a very long history.
And moving on from Europe, a very interesting chapter in the book is on Islam and Islam's complicated relationship with wine. Tell us a bit about the wine culture in Arabia pre-Islamic times. What is that like? And then with the arrival of Muhammad and prohibition, give us a flavour of what is actually going on early in the Arabian story of wine.
Well, in Arabia, wine was drunk by everyone for the same reasons as anywhere else. And Arabic poetry had a lot on wine, for example. And the Arabs, that area and a bit further away, but mostly there, is where Muhammad came, established, as we know, from Medina and Mecca nowadays. And it was a question of whether or not wine was going to be allowed. And it was decided for various reasons, mostly because people could get drunk and that was seen as not anything that Allah would like. And so it was prohibited. Well, this had a mixed reception over the next 1,000 years. And although it was prohibited for poor people and for the lesser classes, the rulers indulged in it themselves. So it was very mixed. And one thing that I found extremely interesting that there were three great wine poets. One, of course, was Omar Khayyam, where you couldn't really, it was controlled by a very restrictive type of religion, and so you couldn't be for wine. So he wrote poems that actually talked about wine, but it was also used as a code for what was happening. And you'd gather in your homes, well, this is the literate sort, and drink wine and read your poems to each other. I thought it, they thought of that as the earliest form of samizdat. You know, in Russia, Soviet Union, remember, manuscripts written out would be passed secretly from home to home, reader to reader. And that's roughly, I think, what was happening there. But also, there were two other major poets. And one, Abu Duas, was quite known, the man with the long dangling locks. He was a libertine. Some of the caliphs really liked him. But he was a great poet as well. I mean, people like T.S. Eliot thought he was a brilliant poet. And there was another famous one, but he was more spiritual than, you know, love life and the wine, as it were.
And what does the Quran say specifically about drinking wine?
Various things. In one, there are various places which say, do not drink wine because it's bad for you and Allah doesn't like it. But there are also ones where it's quite clearly people do, because there it says, now, don't go to prayers if you have had wine or been with a woman. So that obviously took it for granted that people were drinking wine. And also, it was supposed to be appalling in the world. But when you went to paradise, along with your 42 virgins per man, there were rivers of wine. So more than one poet said, all right, if it's okay in paradise, what's wrong with it here? And this has been a continuing difficulty, even today, with Muslims.
We only get wine classifications around the mid-19th century. How do wine classifications come about? Are they important? What does it mean for wine?
Well, they came about because Napoleon, the Emperor Napoleon III, in 1855, decided that he wanted to have an exhibition that would have been as great as the British 1851 exhibition. And one thing, it was to show the various products. And the Bordeaux Chamber of Commerce decided it would be the wine, because that was what made them not, in, you know, known and great and so forth. And but how do you decide? And it was decided nothing to do with quality as such. No. It was the price they would call in the market. And the price was set by what the English would pay. And so it was divided into what were called five classes. The first class are the great wines from Bordeaux, and Lafitte, Rothschild, and Chateaubriand, and so forth. And then came down the deuxième classe, the troisième classe, la quatrième classe, cinquième classe, and then everything else, which might be, if the good ones would be called bourgeois, cru bourgeois. And they, when they were discovered, because the Bordeaux brokers did not want anyone to know what the wines were, because they figured people would come straight to the producers and buy it from them and take away a lot of the money from the brokers who bought it from negociants, really, who bought it from the producer, mixed it together into what their own wine was, as it were, and then sold it. So that classification still seems to have been written in stone. It's still used today, in fact, especially by those who buy wine regularly and think that maybe they, either it's an investment, of course, Chinese and the Americans and the British will buy it to invest or to collect. Not everyone, of course, but it was not the case then particularly. And a bit more depends on what critics say about wines. If you go to a shop, as you know, there's a lot of them have these labels on saying, you know, decanter, bronze, metal, that sort of thing. So the question of ranking wines is never stopped. It's just lighter. You know, if you want to drink a wine from one of my favorites, from Georgia or Ukraine, or Germany, or Austria, you don't look at what these various sort of high-grade collector wines and what they say about them, you know enough about them to think, I quite like wine from Ukraine, and you go buy some, you know, and you experiment yourself if you are inclined that way. Otherwise, you find a wine or two that you like, and you buy that and drink that. So there is, in every country, but especially in Britain, a habit now of exploring in a way that when you felt you had to do, you know, what the major critics, Robert Parker, those in the 20 and 20, especially the 20th and 21st centuries will know, what he said would raise and lower a price of wine. Bordeaux would not say what the cost of their wine would be till Parker had given it a rank. So that is no longer particularly the case. There are wine critics who one follows because you trust their taste. But on the whole, there's a lot more experimentation. Wine merchants give tastings in their shops, and winemakers come over and visit, and you can chat to them and drink their Burgundy, that sort of thing. It's a much more democratic approach to wine now than used to be the case.
I find the wine culture in the US very interesting, and you spend a chapter on the US. You say that around 2/5 of Americans don't drink, and around 70% of Americans don't drink wine. And yet, every shop I go into, there's lots and lots of Californian wine, Zinfandel and things like that. But I just wonder... And there's lots of great wine in America. I was in Idaho recently for a wedding. We were on the Snake River, a dusty part of Idaho. But we were at this vineyard, very, very good wine that you would never hear of. And then we drank some wine from the Walla Walla Valley in Washington.
Great wine out of Washington State and Oregon. Every state, all 50 states, produce wine.
And so why is there not a wine culture? You're naming all this good wine from America, and there's lots of wine-growing regions in every state. Why hasn't a wine culture developed?
For one thing, America has always been a spirits culture. Demon rum, you know, whiskey, hooch, made in stills out in the forest or whatever. So that really established a spirits culture. I suppose wine was an elite drink for a long time, in fact. A lot of wine was destroyed in Prohibition from 1920 to 33. It nearly destroyed wine producing in California, for example, and a lot of other places, which then gradually reestablished itself. And the one real problem, well, one of many real problems about Prohibition is that in the earlier time, people drank dry wine. But during Prohibition, when you had illegal wine, or you could use wine for church purposes, it was sweet. And so they got in the habit of sweet wine, in fact. I mean, Prohibition, which was one of the major chapters on America that I wrote, was quite fun because the Prohibition law had a couple of loopholes. For example, you could make fruit drinks. Well, obviously, it didn't occur to these legislators that grapes were fruit. And so what would happen was that in California, they would ship grapes to the East Coast or to the, you know, Chicago. Italians especially made it at home. And they would be pressed into bricks, in fact. And they'd be wrapped up with a note inside saying, this is a packet of yeast. Now, if you put that when you press your grapes, it would turn into wine, and that's illegal. So there was a lot of wine continuing to be drunk. Bad wine. Not good wine. People got out of the habit of drinking good wine, unless you were really well off, especially in New York and San Francisco, for example, which are the two main areas nowadays of you know, good wine centers.
And it's a substantial book. It's like a narrative encyclopedia. I've read lots of wine books that are very encyclopedic in nature, very helpful. You can go to the index, find the grape or the region and you know, it's good for what it is. But it's very nice to read your book because it has a story and a narrative, and I just very much enjoyed that. But at the end of your book, you talk about climate change, and we're talking about plants, we're talking about vines and the sun and the terroir, and we are relying on the natural world for everything. So how will climate change affect wine going forward?
Well, it depends on where you are. It's getting hotter from the south and moving north. One of my favorite types of wine, the Châteauneuf du Pape, which is in the southern Rhone Valley, they're having real difficulties. Even a grape that is a hot wine grape, all sorts of areas as it moves north is getting hotter and hotter. Bordeaux is going to be one of the really ones really hit even more than it is now. But as this, not all countries suffered. I mean, for example, as Germany gets warmer, you all of a sudden there's quite a lot of red wine being produced in Germany, in fact, and white wines that can be a bit different because the climate allows it. As you get north, Norway now has a number of really good wineries. Mm-hmm. So does Sweden. Even Denmark has a few. So what it does is changing the areas that are wine growing areas. It's very difficult in Tunisia and Morocco, both of which, and Algeria for that matter, have been producing quite nice wines this last generation or two. It's going to be very difficult for them. They have to choose very carefully where your shady areas are and so forth. Another thing that's happening is that certain grapes do not thrive in areas. And so, for example, Bordeaux has decided that there are 10 other types of grapes that can now be planted in Bordeaux. One is Tarrega Nacional, which is the major Portuguese grape. So you're getting different types of grape. What's this going to do to the characteristics of Bordeaux wine, for example? If you've got two of these other vines, Burgundy, of course, stands out because the Burgundian growers, when they were it was suggested, they substitute other grapes for their great grape that makes Burgundy, which is the Pinot Noir. And it is said that the temperature in Germany and the temperature in Burgundy shot up from the outrage of the Burgundian growers, that it should be changed at all. So most quality wine growers are trying to stick it out one way or another. But how inexorable is climate change going to be? All sorts of attempts to modify it, to ameliorate it. But, you know, it's us against the world.
Well, Professor Kathleen Burke, thank you very much.
My pleasure. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to the EI podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please sign up to our mailing list and download the Engelsberg Ideas app. Explore intelligent perspectives on history, culture, and geopolitics anytime, anywhere. And best of all, it's totally free. Until next time, thanks for listening.